A new book is out this month. We'll meet the author on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Salvatore Merici is here to tell us about his new book of poetry, after which Garrison Keillor will tell us about the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. You just don't stop writing, do you, Sal?
Well, I try to every day. I try to spend about 4 hours a day on poetry, but and that includes trying to be shameless at times, trying to promote your book, and so you got to put that in a time frame too.
But you know, that has got to be one of the toughest things about writing poetry, is to promote the book. Promote the poems. Poetry is not selling like hotcakes.
No.
Well, people have always, well, not always, I think, but certainly in my teaching career, the one thing that students beyond sixth grade hate is poetry. You know, you ask a third grader to write poems or to listen to poems, they listen intently. Everybody wants to read. By the time you get to sixth grade, and certainly by the time they get to college, well, poetry was just never my thing. I just never got into poetry. I just can't understand poetry. Yeah. Why is that?
I think it's that the education process is one thing.
We teachers are to blame.
Yeah, well, kind of, yes, unfortunately.
What did we do wrong?
Well, I think what it is that, you know, you have a poem, and I never had to do this, but they did diagrams of poems before. I seen once or twice, I was done. Totally lost, got confused. But, you know, they say, well, what does this poem mean? And there's various hidden levels in a poem. And a lot of times when they say, well, it means this, the teacher goes, no, it means that. And so I think that kind of turns people off of trying to interpret a poem and get feelings out of the poem.
Doesn't turn us off if my math is wrong and the teacher corrects me. Why should a teacher correcting my interpretation
because
of poetry?
Math has an equal sign and poetry has your internal experience that could help define what the person, the poet's writing.
Don't you think it's the poems they're taught? If you were to stick with something like Phyllis McGinley, if poems like that, which, you know, that's verse. Verse is fine. Verse is wonderful. And if it's well done, you know, if you could put poems like that, but we get back into, you know, the heavy English stuff rather too suddenly. And I think it's, you ought to let the student kind of guide how they will go into poetry.
Yeah, and there's a lot of poems that I don't understand. I'll read it, and if I read a poem, and if the music sounds good, or I think I understand it, or there's some nice imagery, even though I don't quite understand it, I'll go back and read it. But there's some poems that, you know, wow, this is really, it doesn't do anything for me, it doesn't take me anywhere. And you know, and that's all right, because there is the thing is, if a reader reads it, he has his or her has a chance to get a feel for the poem. But to get the person to read it first, that's the whole thing.
Well, and the thing is, it's poetry that has to do with contemporary life, rather than Lancelot and Elaine. You know, Young Lochinvar's Come Out of the West. Although that gallops along very nicely, but there are poems that are not wrapped in mysteries. They're marvelous. They bring you up short. They're easy to read. Why don't we use those?
Well, I try to.
Well, because a lot of teachers are afraid of those poems, too. They've been taught Lochinvar, so it's easy to teach Lochinvar, right? And Lochinvar goes on being taught. I don't think that's true much anymore. I think teaching of poetry has changed a little bit, but I know where Sal is coming from.
Yeah.
Well, I know a teacher at UT some years ago. At every class, he'd pause for Bullwinkle's Corner. And Bullwinkle, you recall, and Rocky and Bullwinkle's
right.
always reading poetry.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they'd have some poems. And the kids would bring in some poems, and he'd bring in some poems. And they were not deathless works, but the kids liked Bullwinkle's Corner
right.
and reading and hearing poetry. And it's just that giving the kids an in to that in the selection of poems and so on, I think makes a big difference. Because then poetry will stay with you all your life. You'll go on to T.S. Eliot, but that'll be a more natural progression if you hit him much later.
Yeah.
So, well, we've solved that problem.
Well, I try to make my poems accessible, and I try to tell people that my poetry's for the masses. And,
well, read us mass poetry.
Okay,
here.
I'm going to read a poem. And I know in August, in April, a couple months ago, and poetry, my guys were having a discussion about politics and poetry. Well, in May, our king, Trump, went to the Vatican and met the Pope. And he gave the, and Trump gave, or the Pope gave Trump a copy of the encyclical of global warming.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yes. So anyway, here's a poem. Encyclical. Epigraph. Temperatures rising. Can't see no sky. Can't see no future. John Lennon. Shepherds pointed at stars. Drew deities. Hubble's photos. Spur arguments. About our spirituality. About our beginnings. Here on Earth, Pope Francis speaks, if we destroy this planet, this marvelous creation, it will destroy us.
That's true.
Take us back. I want to talk a little bit more about how, for you, a poem ends up getting down on a page. What triggered that particular poem? Is there a word? Do you start with a line? Do you start with an idea? Or what do you begin with?
Well, I think at that time, I think Pope Francis was in the United States, and he was talking about global warming. And I think also at that time, the Hubble photographs, and there's, for some reason, it was making the news because it outlived its life expectancy, still doing that. And bringing back all these photographs that our people are just thinking about their spirituality, how this world was created, how the universe was created. And so I think that's how it got me started to write this poem.
So the Hubble and Pope Francis
that
sort of came together?
Yes. And then I was listening to one of John Lennon's albums, and I heard this. I go, well, gee, I know that's a cut. Total subject he's talking about in his song. It was I think it was a heroin when he didn't get his heroin. That's, I think that was happening for that song. But I kind of then I start working, and when I write a poem, I really don't know where a poem is going, or even
so
if it's going.
Was
to
there a first word, a line that started that poem?
I had to look at about 40 revisions back
wow.
to see. You know, I'll be typing along. I'm not sure how I start, but maybe I'll be just starting what Pope Francis said or something about a Hubble photos, and then I'll go off on tangents. And then something will kick in, and then I could then start cutting out, maybe find a direction.
Well, how do you know what to cut out?
Oh, well, that is called craft.
You know, your poem is...
Well, what's your...
Your new book of poems is called Fermentations.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, you bubble up all over the page.
Well, you cut out what's not needed. Once you know where the direction is going, you're going to say, well, yeah, this is a really good line. It's visual, but is that line needed for the poem?
So you're saying
take it out.
You don't write poems, you discover them.
Yeah. Once you get the discovery, then you start writing it. I mean, the discovery part is it's all over the place. I mean, I just sit there. I do use a keyboard, and mainly because at the later part of my working career, we had to write on the computer. Even simple email next to the secretary, we had to do everything on the computer. So I kind of learned and to move things around. But when I begin to write something, it makes no sense at all. It really doesn't. It's just a bunch of words and lines, and then I'll catch something. And I don't remember exactly what caught me on this, but I think, I was so happy to see Pope Francis talk about global warming and then the Hubble photo, and then maybe I woke up in the middle of the night and see maybe they could link together somehow.
Read us another poem.
Okay. I'm going to read this poem. You guys have heard it before, and it's called 12:30 p.m. Thanksgiving Day Ritual, and it's dedicated to Helen Beeler. After I put a turkey in my oven, and before the juices drip, Kathy and I walk from my garage across the township's blacktop to Steve's and Helen's farmhouse, built in early 1900s. My right hand carries an uncorked Cabernet Sauvignon. Steve sets four glasses he cut from bottles on the kitchen table, pours. Helen rows her walker to the wooden chair with three pillows. We sit. She keeps the two prongs of the oxygen concentrator's plastic tube stretched from the living room in her nostrils. Under lawn and cream polished nails, Helen's fingers push a white bubble. A pink pill tears thin tinfoil. Her voice raps. I lived with cancer for 10 years. First time I need to take something for nausea. Wine slips medicine. The machine clicks, sighs. The doctor wants to try a new chemo, but we do not know if the insurance will pay for it. She lifts and tilts the vessel. Her bottom lip seals the edge. Red fluid leaves and disappears. She holds the empty container to Steve. I don't know if I care. My body tells me enough. A couple sips drip from the upside-down bottle. We got a lot to be thankful.
That's good.
That is.
Now, let me play the nasty English teacher.
Okay.
You say one of the things you do is cut out all sorts of extraneous lines.
Yes.
Why did you keep the line built in the early 1900s?
I did that just to give imagery, to give a person a feel of the house they lived in. I think that the 1900s old farmhouse would be so much more visual and so much more earthy as these people were, as to a new mansion that's down the road.
Plus, it certainly fits their situation.
It fits their situation.
Right. Okay.
And imagery is I think it's so important in poetry. I try not to tell people what to think. I try to get the imagery, a narrative, sometimes a literal sense that something surrounds a central theme. But I really try not to point the finger at somebody and say, this is what the poem is about. And I want them to see the imagery, sees what happens, and hopefully, well, not even hopefully, but if I could keep a reader involved into the poem and they see what's happening and they feel it and they smell it, and if they get what I got out of it, that's great. Sometimes they don't. And if they don't, they see something completely different. I go, wow, thank you. I didn't know I was that good.
Now, Thursday, you're going to be busy with something.
Yes. At the Rock Island Rock Island Library, I still get nasty nightmares when I worked at the Arsenal. So, I will be doing a reading at 6 o'clock p.m., and this is with the Midwest Writing Center and Corporation in cooperation with the Rock Island Library. And I can read to you what the evening will be about. It is a bold and rising celebration of yeast, place, elements, transformation. You will board into an evening of intermingled fantasies, nightmares, good times, and the realities of our days. Journey through your senses as I perform poems from my new collection, Fermentations, and some from my earlier collections, Swiss Shrew and Sniff, and Mortals, Nature, and Their Spirits.
So that'll be Thursday night at the Rock Island Library.
Yes, at 6 p.m.
Very good. Well, we invite
books will be available there, right?
Of course, books will be available, and if there's not people out there, I'm sure I'll be out in the front.
I've seen you out in the streets saying, come on into the poetry reading.
Well, you know, and merchandising is a lot of the game.
It
really is. Well, good luck to you, and thank you for sharing your new work with us. And we'll encourage our listeners to be at the Rock Island Public Library 6 p.m. this Thursday. Salvatore Merici will be there reading from his new collection, Fermentations. And right now, Garrison Keillor will be reading from The Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. You know, listening to Sal, I was thinking, you are churning out these little limericks. When are you going to publish your book of poetry?
Well, once I get a few more. My one for today, would you like to hear it? You have no choice. You have to listen to it. Here it is. Senator Don Wooten was deft at deciding which bills had most heft. I stack up a pile, let the wind blow a while, and those are all right that are left. You can take left however you may wish to take that.
You'll be punished somewhere.
Well, there's more, Don.
If there is a just God, you will be punished.
Well, we will find out.
Yes, we will. In the meantime.
But I have an absolutely delightful book that I love books that sound improbable on the surface and turn out to be really delightful. The title of this book, and it came out too last year, is The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating by Elizabeth Bailey. And it turns out that Elizabeth Bailey, the author, this is an English book, has spent the past two decades in bed felled by one of those viruses that nobody can kind of figure out and makes her almost immobile. Huh. Too tired even to get out of bed. And as far as I know, that's where she still is. Outside of that, it has not affected her mind. It hasn't affected. But she is confined to whatever is near her bed. And shortly after she was confined to bed, two decades ago, a friend brought over a pot of wild violets that she dug up from the garden. And in that pile of wild, in that little pot of wild violets, there turned out to be a land snail. And so she started watching the snail, and it would creep out of the pot and creep down, and and look for things to eat, and obviously it was hungry. And after a week or so, she discovered that it liked mushrooms, and that when the snail eats, it eats a square hole, just because of the way its teeth operate. And also that if you're very careful and very silent, you can actually hear the snail going as it carves little holes in things. She ended up having it put in a little terrarium near her with all sorts of other things, and as kept on feeding it, and watched it travel, and began to study snails. And eventually she discovered that snails don't need mates to mate. They can become any sex they want. And eventually there were many, many other snails in there. She discovered how snails live, where they live, how they dig their holes to live in, and has literally spent the past couple of decades watching snails and not being bored by it at all, because it is such a – I mean, anything in nature – I know eventually you're going to talk about astrophysics, there's some big things going on there, little things. Nature is endlessly fascinating.
Oh, that's for sure.
And while I find snails interesting, I never thought I would like a 300-page book on snails. But I do. I mean, this is a really charming book. It's The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. And it one of those books that is just going to make you feel really good. You don't even really feel sorry for Elizabeth Bailey confined to her bed. She doesn't make much of it. What she makes of it is the way this snail lives and its lifestyle, its lifespan. She has friends who take the extra snails out and put them in the woods so that they'll have a life of their own and not be confined to the terrarium. It is just a fun book, well written.
You know, you can spiral down like that to very small things and find them profoundly interesting. Back in the days when I was doing TV documentaries on a variety of subjects, it occurred to me that the world is so complex and there's so many things in it that I could do a half-hour television documentary on a square foot of ground, dig it up to a depth of about 6 to 8 inches, and there's enough life in there to talk about. And what scientists have discovered is that we really don't know what's down there. If you dig down into the earth, the life that lives there, we actually know very little about it.
Right.
And there's so many things in this world. The world is such an intricately structured object. It has so many facets that we just don't know about, that you could spend a lifetime just examining one thing, like a snail.
Well, and there are scientists who do, right?
And, you know, sometimes people think, boy, what a way to spend your life. But actually, as that book demonstrates, it can be fascinating.
Yeah, well, it is. It's ultimately great.
The title again, which I love.
The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating.
I love it. Well, we'll make sounds of our own again next week when we return, as we hope you will, for the next edition of Scribble.